Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Welcome to All About Agatha, the podcast dedicated to reading and ranking every single mystery novel written by the Queen of Crime, Dame Agatha Christie. I'm Catherine Brobeck.
And I'm Kemper Donovan.
And this week, we are tackling a short story, The Girl in the Train. You heard that right. It's not The Girl on the Train.
A little bit of prepositional play here.
Indeed. But it does involve a girl on a train. It's just slightly less gin and tonic. How about that?
If we're going to play the prepositional game, I think I much prefer The Girl Under the Train, a.k.a. Anna Karenina.
Har. You know, I will have you know.
Sorry for spoiling Anna Karenina for anyone out there.
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that in case you didn't know. You know, at a certain point, I feel like a spoiler alert for a book that came out more than 150 years ago is not warranted.
And for the listeners of this podcast, I think is especially not warranted.
Do you know, Kemper, I don't know if you know this, a few years ago for Halloween, I went as post-train Anna Karenina.
Oh, boy. So you really were the girl under the train.
Really the girl under the train. I, like, did tracks on my back, and I had zombie makeup on.
Wow.
A corset, a ball skirt, a fur.
That is a window into Catherine Brobeck, if ever there was a window.
I know. If anybody has ever wanted to learn way too much about me, I think that they just all experienced that.
Here's my question. Has there been a girl over the train? I was thinking about this. I couldn't really think of one.
Girl over the train. Well,
the best I could come up with was boy over the train, i.e. Keanu Reeves
James
at the
Bond?
Very end of Speed or something.
Oh,
I don't know.
No, I was going to say there's at least one or two James Bonds, I think, where there is action on top of a moving train.
Well, actually, the most recent Murder on the Orient Express.
I know.
Kenneth Branagh was a bit of a man over the train.
That's true also.
I think we've had our prepositional fun.
We've exhausted this premise.
I think we've exhausted this premise, yes. Let's talk about the publication history, Catherine.
This was first published in the Grand Magazine in February 1924, and it's part of that Listerdale mystery collection, or if you were an American reader, the Golden Ball, which we talked about last week.
Absolutely. Let's talk about our victim. This is not a murder mystery, not in any way whatsoever. Our victim, though, is the titular girl in the train, and her name is Elizabeth. She is being hunted down by some angry Eastern European men on a train.
They might be German. It's sort of ambiguous.
Yeah, they're not English and vaguely menacing in accent. They're from the continent, yes. Let's talk about her suspects.
So our suspects are aforementioned vague continental foreigners.
Also a bearded man who is on the train, and Elizabeth warns our hero, George, who we will meet in just a moment. He is neither victim nor suspect, which is why we haven't mentioned him yet. But Elizabeth warns our protagonist hero, George, to keep his eye on this bearded man and to trail him off the train. So that is what George does, following him to Portsmouth, which is where much of our story takes place. Which I think is a seamless transition into the world as it appears to be.
George is sort of a rich kind of ne'er-do-well. I wouldn't really call him a ne'er-do-well. He was employed by his uncle, and he's been fired because he seems bad at life. And he's really kind of embittered by it, but he clearly is privileged enough to not let that one little blow keep him down. So he looks at a map and he decides to go off to Rollins Castle, since that's his last name, and he figures he must have relations there and, you know, they'll elect him mayor.
Right. It's pretty obvious from the first page that we're in breezy thriller Christie mode here. And again, this is written in 1924. This story to me feels feels adjacent to Why Didn't They Ask Evans, The Secret of Chimneys, and their ilk. It's early Christie. Let's just put it that way. It's early Christie.
There's not a lot going on here.
Right.
You know what? In fairness to this story, that's the kindest way to look at this. It's a breezy read, and there's not a lot going on here.
This is true. I did appreciate that there was another reference to soldiers selling poems door to door, though.
I know.
Agatha Christie really had
How
a thing about...
How commonplace was that? I mean, like, I know that it was a thing that happened after the First World War, but how commonplace was it that she feels compelled to reference it multiple times?
I know, and she definitely referenced it in The Secret of Chimneys. I remember there was a big ongoing joke about that. I feel like she must have had at least one experience in which a soldier really pathetically tried hard to sell her a really bad poem. It probably only took once for it to be seared in her brain, but who knows? Maybe it happened dozens of times. I don't know.
It's
she just
so
she just clearly remembered it and referenced it a lot.
It's one of the bleaker Christie asides because it's never like a plot point really, but it's such a bleak aside.
Also, in keeping with the breezy yet bleak asides, there's also a quoting of The Charge of the Light Brigade.
There definitely is.
I mean, The Charge of the Light Brigade, I will just always remember from middle school and how breezily depressing it is. So it's a perfect reference here.
It is. It's also one of those slightly embarrassing poems that I feel like at one point in history, many a person was probably meant to memorize.
Yes. It's become a little basic, for lack of a better word. I feel like we overuse that modern phrase, but yeah. So George gets on the train, and while on the train in a privileged first-class car all to himself, a frantic girl rushes in, pursued by this suspicious Eastern European slash German slash continental man. And George is fairly delighted to be protecting a damsel in distress. So he lies about her presence because what the girl actually does is to hide underneath the seat within the car. So
as though that would not be noticeable.
You'd probably be able to notice, and I think I even had that issue when I was reading the story, but, and this is where we can bring up the fact that, yes, there is an adaptation of this story. It is part of the Agatha Christie Hour, which we've already referenced, and the way that it was staged, you really couldn't see her because it kind of had like a bit of fabric coming down on the side that was facing into the car, and she really was fully concealed, so... Hats off, Agatha Christie Hour, for bringing that scene alive in this imagination challenge reader's mind.
Making it very convincing.
Yeah, so she's hiding. This man is asking for his niece, right? Isn't that what he says?
Right. Yeah. Yes.
He says, "Where's my niece? Where's my niece?" And George says, "I have no idea." The train moves on.
Correct. And I think that this is slightly unclear, but I assume that this is Prince Osric. We don't find this out till the end.
Stop spoiling, Catherine. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here. We need to follow the twisty-turny story that is ahead of us.
I'm so sorry. We will just continue to refer to him as a vaguely suspicious man from the continent.
One step at a time here. So the train moves on. The girl is safe. She eventually emerges from underneath the seat and introduces herself as Elizabeth.
Right. And so she's in imminent danger, presumably from this man who's ran after her. And so she slips George this small package. She also begs him to please keep an eye on this other man who's this bearded gentleman. And if he could please follow the bearded gentleman to his final destination, that would be a huge favor to her. And of course, she's very pretty and George is very stupid. So...
So is George stupid? I don't know if George is stupid. I think he's just enthusiastic and naive.
That's fair. And apparently not very good at working for his own uncle.
Right. We definitely get the sense when he's fired by his uncle that it's not like he's unfairly fired.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, George now has a mission.
Yes.
That's something. He has to be able to follow this beardo.
So he follows him. The last stop is Portsmouth, and that is where the bearded man gets off.
Yes, and he checks himself into a hotel.
Right. And I don't know about you, Catherine, but when I hear Portsmouth, I think of Mansfield Park and Fanny going to her poor relations and that very depressing sequence. So I always get a little depressed, actually. Apologies to anyone who's listening to this in Portsmouth.
I know, I was about to say, all of our listeners in Portsmouth.
Well, no, I mean, clearly I've never been to Portsmouth, but what I appreciated actually from the story is that this story put a little bit more of a glittery and enjoyable spin on what had always had a little bit of a sheen of depression and despair for me. So there you go. So
I think what we're saying is that Jane Austen has really caused a bad reputation. It's not you.
It's true. It's Jane Austen's fault, Portsmouth listeners. I don't know. I might write a strongly worded letter to the Jane Austen Society. See what you can do about that. But come on, it really is a really depressing sequence when she hasn't seen her family in like 10 years and she goes back to their house. And I remember she's like shocked by how small it is and how bad the conditions are. And she's just totally alienated from her immediate family who sent her away. And it's awful.
It is awful. Nobody's going to argue with you.
But is it Portsmouth's fault? I think is your...
my argument. I don't really think that that's the fault of the city, but, you know.
But so Jane Austen, and people don't give her credit for this, Jane Austen actually really does evoke certain cities extraordinarily well. The other one obviously being Bath in Northanger Abbey. And Bath I have been to, and I feel like I knew sort of what it looked like, or what at least the Regency era portion of it looked like from that novel. And I remember when reading Mansfield Park, Portsmouth felt evoked for me. So Jane Austen's fault. It's on Jane Austen, everyone.
You know, I have also been to Bath. And my memory of Bath will always be that I was expecting some sort of Regency elegance, and instead I ended up in it was not quite a hostel situation. I suppose it was a bed and breakfast, but there was no shampoo, so I had to wash my hair with soap, and it was very humid.
Ooh.
Yes, and so then I got to walk around the Crescent and go to the Roman baths with hair that was essentially clown hair.
Well, I remember all sorts of elegant and regal crescent-shaped streets and white stone facades, and clearly we had very different Bath experiences.
It's a beautiful city. My hair might have been in my way. I might have been having to look through it, but, you know, it was a beautiful city regardless.
All right, back to Portsmouth. Mm-hmm. George checks into this hotel, and he also has a feeling that he himself is being watched, perhaps by the man that he is watching, this bearded man, but also this ginger-haired man, this redheaded gentleman. And mm-hmm. even worse, a little bit into this adventure at the hotel here, George gets cornered by two quote-unquote foreigners who appear to be, again, vaguely German or Eastern European or Balkan. And actually, there's a really good reason for why we are being vague about where these people are from.
Because it's a fake country.
They're from the country of Catonia, which is a small Balkan country. And let's refer back now. I mentioned this is adjacent to The Secret of Chimneys, Herzoslovakia, if you will.
Right.
Yes. I think Catonia and Herzoslovakia are sister countries, i.e. they're both fake. That is, in fact, where these gentlemen all hail from. And it would appear that one of those two men is the one who had been on the train.
Who's on the train. And then also a younger man who is incredibly angry because mm-hmm. he seems to have a possessiveness towards the person who we now find out is, in fact, the Grand Duchess Anastasia Sophia Alexandra Marie Helena Olga Elizabeth of Catonia, also known as Alexa.
Alexa.
Alexa, how many tablespoons are in 3/4 cup?
3/4 cups is 12 tablespoons.
Or, as George then insultingly knows her, Elizabeth. That's how he refers to her. And this younger gentleman practically whips out his glove and slaps him in the face a bunch of times. He actually really does want to fight him, right, for his impertinence at calling the Grand Duchess Elizabeth. But George assumes... Again, assumes in an Agatha Christie story, even in a breezy thriller like this, not something you want to do, but he assumes that Elizabeth must be the Grand Duchess. He says he doesn't know where she is and he's not going to help them. And good day.
Yes, good day.
You get nothing. You lose. Good day, sir.
He also doesn't know where she is because also he doesn't even know who she is.
Right, exactly. He neither knows who nor where she is.
Right. So George is not actually pulling some great spycraft here. He just actually is ignorant.
So George is totally freaked out, but somehow he still manages to find time to stalk this bearded gentleman. Again, let's not forget him, who he sees hiding something in the floorboards. In the interim, he manages to actually lose that secret package that Elizabeth told him to keep a handle on. His room gets ransacked, right? And it disappears. But then it reappears the next morning, and he opens the box, and it has been tampered with. So
it's been opened.
He sees that it's a wedding ring inside. Yeah. But if I were him, I'd be like, was that originally what was inside? Or did someone just put like a Cracker Jack ring in here?
Actually appear to think that. So
I know.
We can think that, but George does not think that.
So then what happens next, Catherine?
George ends up breaking back into our bearded friend's room. But there he encounters that suspicious redhead. Mm-hmm. And that guy turned out to be Inspector Gerald of Scotland Yard.
What?
Yeah. And apparently he's been following George, who's been following the bearded guy. And the bearded guy appears to be a spy who was hiding harbor maps of Portsmouth in conjunction with somebody named Betty Bright Eyes, which is a pretty cool, nefarious name.
Her name is Betty, which is a nickname Elizabeth, and she's known for being very beautiful and having beautiful eyes. And George has this sinking feeling of, oh no, Elizabeth is not the Grand Duchess. She's actually Betty Bright Eyes, and I've been had here.
Helping a spy, get maps of the Portsmouth Harbor. So it's not great. And so George kind of gives up at this point and realizes he needs to go back to either his campaign to become mayor of Rollins Castle or to go back to London.
And perhaps beg for his job from his uncle.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that listeners might be wondering why at no point have we actually come to the world as it actually is.
And that's because there aren't any clues. Not only are there not any clues, but there's almost no mystery.
Nope.
The mystery is, who is Elizabeth? And the answer turns out to be neither the Grand Duchess nor Betty Bright Eyes, but someone else whose name is actually Elizabeth.
But they're all named Elizabeth. So Betty Bright Eyes is presumably named Elizabeth. Right. The Duchess.
Well, the Duchess has like 18 names, and one of them happens to be Elizabeth, but yes.
Yeah, and so, but the girl in the train is also Elizabeth.
And the girl in the train reemerges when he gets back on the train.
On the train. She embarks at a random town and somehow manages to figure out the car that George is in.
Do we think she's like riding the rails? Is she like a hobo?
Like a hobo? It would make as much sense.
So who is she, Catherine?
She is the sister of the Duchess's fiance / now husband, because he in fact is a British lord.
Right.
And her uncle, Prince Osric, wanted her to be married to Prince Carl, who I guess is the creepy young one.
Right. It seems like Prince Osric is definitely the older of the foreign gentlemen who had been speaking to George, and almost definitely is also the man who had been pursuing Elizabeth on the train at the beginning of the story.
Right. Right. So what happens is this. The two women decide to pull a switcheroo. I like to think that's the technical term, switcheroo.
Sure.
So they switch clothes in the back of a cab going to the train station in London. It is Elizabeth who allows herself to be pursued instead of the Duchess.
Right.
And so then the Duchess can flee to the country to be married in peace while Elizabeth continues this chase to prevent her from being married.
Elizabeth puts the Grand Duchess's uncle off of the scent because the Grand Duchess wanted to marry Elizabeth's brother, Lord Gay. That's G-A-I-G-H. And her uncle was trying to force her to marry Prince Carl, who was the creepy, goony, younger person who George had met and who we're definitely supposed to hate.
Right.
So Elizabeth obviously was also interested in having this marriage come off, and they performed the switcheroo to make that happen.
Again, technical term.
Yes, technical term, switcheroo. Why, you may ask, did Elizabeth then give George a box with a ring inside of it and tell him to safeguard it and also to watch that bearded gentleman? Because she thought he seemed like he needed something to do, and she thought it would be fun to just randomly pick a man who happened to be on the train and give him the ring that she just had on her, because that was, of course, the ring that was going to be used in the ceremony, which I guess had been kind of interrupted, and it didn't really matter. They didn't really need the ring.
They didn't care that much, apparently.
They didn't care that much about the ring. So she kind of just had a spare ring lying around.
You know, we talk about MacGuffins. I don't know that we talk about MacGuffins very often, but a MacGuffin obviously is a trope.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the few cases where I can think of somebody intentionally creating a MacGuffin.
Right. It's not a MacGuffin as a trope. It's actually a MacGuffin within the story.
Right.
That's true. Like, Elizabeth gave him the ring as a MacGuffin.
Mm-hmm.
Agreed. That's true. That is unusual. In case it's more of an American term, I don't really think it is, but a MacGuffin being an object.
The Maltese Falcon is right. A MacGuffin.
That may be, but I've got the Falcon.
I shouldn't think it would be necessary to remind you, Mr. Spade, that you may have the Falcon, but we certainly have you.
Some sort of fascination or focal point of a story that doesn't matter in and of itself.
An object to chase.
Right.
For example.
Elizabeth did, as we said, try really hard to find George again. It's pretty miraculous that she was able to find him as easily.
The train stopped at a small station and a lady got in. She sat down opposite him. Good morning, George. She said sweetly. Good heavens, cried George. Elizabeth.
Right. Again, I think Elizabeth is just riding the rails. I think Elizabeth is a hobo. She's been sleeping in a train for like the last week.
It seems distinctly possible. Yeah, just going from station to station.
Yeah, I like what Elizabeth said about all this MacGuffin business. I hope you won't be awfully cross. You see, you looked so keen on its being a real mystery, like in books, that I really couldn't resist the temptation. I picked out a rather sinister-looking man on the platform and told you to follow him, and then I thrust the parcel on you.
Although, weirdly enough, by the way, that was a sinister man, and he was actually a spy.
Right, so Elizabeth has good observational skills, so he turned out to be a spy. And we do also know that it was Inspector Gerald of Scotland Yard who stole the box from George's hotel room, looked in it, mm-hmm. and was like, wow, what is this? And then just put it back, realizing that it didn't have anything to do with the case that he was investigating.
Right.
And guess what, listeners? George and Elizabeth live happily ever after.
But it's only because George has the potential to make a good deal of money, because that's mostly what Elizabeth is interested in.
Right. George is able to make a lot of money, and Elizabeth is descended from
a lady.
Nobility.
Well, she's a lady. She's an actual lady. She's a lady, Elizabeth Gay.
So George's uncle will be very excited.
Oh, George, is he very rich? Elizabeth. Are you mercenary? Very. I adore spending money.
Yeah, and her poor father has 5 daughters full of beauty and blue blood. He's just yearning for a rich son-in-law. And George admits that he's a snob. My best dream was one where King George borrowed 500 from me to see him over the weekend. I mean, this is jokey Christie at her best, but I guess also now that we have the context of so many better stories from her, and we can see her, especially in the 30s, as we're closing in on the 40s, honing her craft as well as she did, this is just subpar Christie. It just is. It's not Christie at her best. She's doing something well, and it's enjoyable. And there are some writers that never would have done anything better. But knowing what else she has up her authorial sleeve, it's hard to read these stories from the mid-20s and find them all that satisfying.
But, I mean, that's not universally true. I mean, one in particular.
We went into raptures over the Listerdale mystery. I mean, there is a lot to enjoy in that.
It's lovely. And you know the interesting thing about it, the Listerdale mystery has this sort of perspective on the economy, the real world, as it were, that it exists in. And even Tommy and Tuppence. Mm-hmm. Tommy and Tuppence start their business because they're plucky and broke.
Right. This is not tethered to reality in any way whatsoever. And Christie talks about enjoying those stories and writing them every once in a while. She's blowing off steam.
And it is absolutely a fine read. I don't want to discourage people from reading it. It's just, it doesn't have much of a mystery, and it doesn't really have much in the way of fleshed out characters. I don't know that we can really laud it for that.
Just really briefly about the adaptation, we already mentioned it, Agatha Christie Hour in the early 80s. The adaptation is faithful, as all these adaptations were, except it actually went for a lot more jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Young man, what have you done with my niece?
I haven't the vaguest idea what you're talking about.
Then it was a school?
Very. Get those heads to wrap again.
You have your papers upside down, sir.
I am preparing for a visit to the Antipodes.
There is this whole running joke where he puts a flower in his jacket and it's called an Erica Vagans, which is a type of flower. But every time anyone makes reference to it, he thinks that they're talking about a woman named Erica Vagans. I mean, it is really goofy, but in keeping with the tone of the story. So I actually thought that the adaptation was pretty good. I think they did what they could with it and it was light and enjoyable.
You know, I don't disagree at all because it seems like an outline to a story. Mm-hmm. More than it does anything fleshed out. And so if you look at it as a teleplay structure, you can see where that would go well.
Yeah. So that is The Girl in the Train. Join us next time. We are going to be doing another Parker Pine. This is actually the first Parker Pine within the Parker Pine Investigates collection. And that would be The Case of the Middle-Aged Wife. Catherine's got a lot of thoughts about this one, I believe.
I have a lot of problems with this one.
So lots to discuss there, lots to unpack. And just a reminder that the next novel we are covering is Death on the Nile. We always love hearing from you. You can email us at allaboutthedame@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at allaboutthedame or on Facebook. Our Facebook page is All About Agatha. We're also on Instagram at All About Agatha, and you can tweet Catherine at Brobcat. Please take a moment to rate and review us. We really appreciate you doing that. It helps other people find the podcast. And we will see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.